So we know you have a lot to say, so we're not going to put an upper bound on the length of the lecture.
Well, I wasn't really expecting anyone to come today after yesterday's lecture, so I didn't really prepare very much. I was feeling rather ashamed of myself. I thought I kind of knew all about my own way, at least, of telling you about the linear cohomology, or what perhaps one ought to call Cheeger-Simons differential characters. And I realized, talking to Issinger and Dan Fried afterwards, that I didn't even understand my own point of view, let alone anyone else's. I think it is worth... last night when I was trying to think what I would say today, I realized I'd wandered very far indeed from what I took to be my original project, which was to give rather introductory lectures which would give people some idea of K-theory and its relations with non-commutative geometry and the rudiments of quantum field theory. And particularly in a discussion yesterday afternoon, lots of things kind of were mentioned which I realized it would have made more sense for me to try to somehow bring in. But I'm going to try and rectify that a little bit, even at the expense of not doing what I said I was going to do yesterday. I'll begin by going back to these delinear cohomology classes. And after conversations with my friends, I realized there are a few things I should have said. So remember, we were talking about these things, HP delinear of a smooth manifold X, which had two outputs. On the one hand, they were integral cohomology classes, and on the other hand, they gave you closed smooth P forms with integral periods. Now, as was pointed out to me, if one just wants to know this group, then one can say what it is very simply. This group can be said all in one go. It is simply, I'll explain the words afterwards, it consists exactly of smooth, additive smooth functions from P minus 1 cycles in X to the circle. Now, I want to explain the words smooth and additive. First of all, what does smooth mean? Well, smooth means, you see, that if you vary this cycle a little bit, the thing behaves smoothly. And additive means that, you see, supposing these were one cycles, supposing we had a one cycle that was somehow... supposing I have a one cycle that looks like this, a one cycle which looks like that, and a third one cycle which looks like the outside. Then additive would mean that the value on this one plus the value on that one should be the value on that one. Well, these two words, smooth and additive, can be encoded in the following way. Let's call this function f. We simply say that if f, that we say that if cycle C is the boundary of some other cycle D, then the value of the cycle on D is the integral of this of some smooth form right. It will automatically have integral periods, right? So we encode both smoothness and additivity in the property that there exists a smooth P-form, such that whenever a cycle is the boundary of something, the value on this boundary is the integral of omega over the inside. Now, you see, clearly you don't need, if you give this, you don't need to give omega, because in particular, this prescribes for you the integral of omega over all little disks. I tend to think of this as real numbers modulo 1, but if we want to think of it as complex numbers, we should write it like that. Right, so that's a nice group. And that's the end. I mean, that is exactly what this group is. And you can easily, well, you obviously extract the P form from it, and I'll leave it to you to think how you extract the integral cohomology class. But on the other hand, although that's a complete description of the group, it is nice to say some more about it. For instance, let's consider the case H2, the linear of X, which I said yesterday was isomorphism classes of line bundles with connection. Now, on the other hand, you see, when we say it this way, well, a one cycle lets us to loop. This is just maps from loops in X to the circle. Well, you see, a line bundle has a holonomy around any circle, and giving the holonomy around any circle determines the bundle completely up to isomorphism. So why would anyone but a category theorist think that it's important to be able to talk about these isomorphism classes of objects rather than just simply the circle-valued maps on the loop space? Well, the reason is that we are interested in thinking of these things as local objects because we're actually going to want to think of them, you see, just in electromagnetic theory, when we want to do the theory of the electromagnetic field, we're considering the vibrations of a line bundle with connection on a space X. And it's very important that the line bundle with connection, the electromagnetic field, is a locally defined object on the manifold X. Whereas this thing is not a locally defined thing on X. You see, X might have all kinds of complicated topology, and in order to give this, you have to give its holonomy around loops which maybe go around some rather remote path around all kinds of distant obstacles in the space. So you see, if you take X and you divide it into two parts, X1 and X2, then you see, in order to give the bundle from this point of view, it's not enough to give the bundle on X, it's not enough to give its value on all loops like this, because you see, if you imagine this as being kind of toroidal, think of X1 and X2, it's kind of like that, you'll want to know the holonomy around loops like that, and you can't make up a loop like this out of a loop in this side and a loop in that side. So there is an important philosophical difference between being able to understand an object there and being able to understand an object there. Now, of course, if we want to define the object here, how do we do it? Well, what is a line bundle with connection? Well, you see, the way I'd like to think of a line bundle with connection is that at each point of X, we have a line, LX, and whenever we have a path from X to some other point, X prime, we have a parallel transport operation from this line to that line. And, of course, when we have a closed loop, we just get a number, because we're getting a map from a line to the same line, and that will just be multiplication by a number. But in order to pass from this to this, you see, what we have to do is keep track of the line that we have at each point. And then we already have this kind of object. So if we go up to the next stage, these are the things that were called gerbs, then what happens? Well, you see how madness begins to set in, Because, you see, we now want to be able to give circle-valued functions on things like this, C. Let's call them sigma now because they're closed surfaces. They go to things f of sigma in here. Well, we want to be able to patch these things together, you see, when we cut something in half. So we have to imagine cutting sigma along some one cycle, S. So what would we do? We have to associate to this a line, LS. And we then have the kind of connection on loop space that I mentioned before. You see, here we have a loop, here we have a line, so we have a line bundle, really, on the loop space in X. And it has a kind of connection in that if we want to be able to patch all of these things together, well, you see, when we have this, which you should think of as a cobordism in loop space from nothing to a single circle, this should give us an element of the line L of S. And when you take that half, which you should think of as a cobordism from S to nothing inside X, you should have a map from L of X to this, an element of the dual, and the two things together should give us a number. Perhaps a better way to think of it is, imagine you have cobordism in loop space, we'll have an L of S1, L of S2. We'd like to get a map from here to here. The trouble is, this isn't the end of the story, you see, because if we just give this kind of, this much data, we give a number for each closed surface, and we give a line for each loop for each way of cutting it, we still haven't localized enough, because, you see, we still, you see, we'll immediately then have to ask the question, supposing we have a loop that goes from one, interestingly, around our manifold, how do we make the loop associated to this particular S from something associated to that part of it and something associated to that part of it? So we immediately get into the question, how do we make, if we have a line associated to a loop, how do we piece together that line out of some kind of fragment associated to one half, fragment associated to the other half? Well, that is where, unfortunately, one gets into this category theoretical slippery slope. This stage, one can give nice concrete descriptions, and I gave the description in my first lecture by bundles of algebras. You see, supposing we say that to our naught dimensional manifold, we're now considering cutting a loop into two halves, S1 and S2. Supposing we have an algebra associated to this naught dimensional thing, our one cycle, that's associated to this one cycle, this naught cycle, this pair of points. You see, unfortunately, I can't make a one-dimensional manifold whose boundary is just one point, so it's a little bit... Then I want to give something associated to this and something associated to this so that when I put the two things together, what I extract is a line. Well, you see, what you should associate to this is a module. S1 goes to an A module, M1. And the algebras I have in mind are these simple algebras, things like full matrix algebras. So they have just one irreducible representation up to isomorphism. Any other irreducible representation is the same as this up to a phase. It's like an irreducible representation of a group. If you have two irreducible representations of the same kind, they're isomorphic, but the isomorphism is only determined up to multiplying by a complex number of modulus 1. Well, this piece would be associated to another A module, and how do we get a line out of these things? Well, these two things are isomorphic, so we consider the homomorphisms of A modules from M1 into M2, And that's a unique line, you see, which is associated to the two pieces. So, you see, in this case, what we've associated to something naught-dimensional is a category, the category of irreducible modules of this algebra, and that tells us how to manufacture lines when we want to piece together two parts of the loop in a space. Well, the trouble is, if you keep on going and want to know what happens if you cut more and more and more, you get into worse and worse category theory. And personally, I think one should stay away from that, so I'm not going to pursue this any further. I will just say one more thing before leaving this subject and going back to K-theory. You see, we have this slippery slope of constantly... If we were doing this in dimension P, then to P minus 1 cycles we associate numbers. To P minus 2 cycles we have a line, so we have a line bundle on the P minus 2 cycles. We would then have to have something on the P minus 3 cycles, and if you like, you can say it's an algebra. But then what about the P minus 4 cycles? You see, you need some higher algebraic structure, and you don't want to get into that. The thing that you can do very cheaply, and it is important, I think, in the applications that are coming up, is certainly say that there exists a well-defined class, a well-defined category of objects of type P. So this is not any kind of higher category, this is just an honest category, like a category of line bundles with connection, where an object of type P is going to be a thing which represents an element of the P-th delinear homology group. So this category on X, X being a given manifold. And one reason why that's important, I mean, how would one actually... I'm not going to even tell you how to define this category, but there's a perfectly... there's a perfectly systematic way to do it. You see, if you think in terms of the following description of line bundles with connection, how, after all, do people traditionally, old-fashioned people doing general relativity, how do they think of tangent vector fields on a manifold? Well, they work in terms of local trivializations of the tangent bundle. So the way they would describe a line bundle with connection is to say you give an open covering U alpha of X, and so what's a line bundle with connection? You give a connection form A alpha, which is a one form on each U alpha. But then you say, how does it behave when you go from one thing to the other? Well, you say that in the overlap, that this is equal to dF alpha beta for some F alpha beta, a naught form on U alpha intersection U beta, where this is some real valued function, that's the transition function of the bundle. And you have to say just a little bit more, because you have to see what happens when you have triple intersections. You see, the transition function for this bundle is meant to be not the function f, but e to the 2 pi I f alpha beta. That's the circle valued thing, which is the attaching map to this bundle. And we need some compatibility then. We need these attaching functions to be coherent. So we need that f beta gamma minus f alpha gamma plus f alpha beta is actually an integer, n alpha beta gamma in Z, for whenever we have a triple intersection. You see, so the entire data consists of the open covering, the collection of one forms, the collection of naught forms on the binary intersections, and a collection of integers on the triple intersections. And of course, this triple thing represents the integer cohomology class, and the actual two form, which was what we were trying to model, of course, doesn't quite appear in that description directly at all. So you can say a slew of data like this is a line bundle with connection, and it's clear what we mean by a morphism of them in that description. But once you give it in this description, you can give it for any P, because we just give a P minus one, we'd give an open covering, a P minus one form on each set, a P minus two form satisfying a relation like this on each overlap, a P minus three form on the triple overlaps, and then so on.
Can you explain that with the exponent over there with the 2π?
Oh, well, you see, this bundle is a complex line bundle, so it's a touching map. You have to give a map into the group of the bundle, so that's a multiplicative complex number, and I'm making a Hermitian bundle, so it's a complex number of modulus 1. So the attaching map, when I go from the trivialization over U alpha to the trivialization over U beta, is multiplying by some complex valued function of modulus 1. Now, we want to write in this description, you might think, why not just take this number rather than take F alpha beta? Why did I take the logarithm? Well, if you think about what I would do at the next stage up, where this was going to be a 2 form, then this was, the Fs were going to be 1 forms, then I don't want to start exponentiating a 1 form. So I want to give, I don't want to be talking about circle-valued 1 forms, I want to be talking about real-valued 1 forms. So you actually want to choose in the overlap this logarithm. But when you do that, you'll introduce a problem, because that F alpha beta wasn't unique. We'll introduce this problem of the integer discrepancy when we patch things together. You might think, in fact, at the lowest level, when you get down to omega naught, you could actually give these circle-valued things and avoid that integer. But somehow it's better to work systematically with differential forms of each degree, which have honest values rather than circle-valued things. And then you have to keep the integer that pops out at the end of the process.
Right.
Yeah. Again?
We can consider
connections on physical buffers. No, if you're asking me how to do this non-abelian, I'm just not getting into that. that's an ongoing thing between me and Greg. And also, it's an ongoing thing, I should say, for mathematicians in general. The definition of non-abelian cohomology is a much argued over story, which is not part of this lecture. The last thing before I leave this, and I really do want to leave it now, is to say, you see, why is it important? There's another reason why it's important to have the objects if we're doing field theory. And it's perhaps the more important one for the applications in string theory. You see, the moment you... a delinear object of type 1, remember, that's just a map from X to the circle. So circle-valued functions. Now, the moment you have an element of H2DX, that's a line bundle, well, we can think of it as circle bundles. Instead of thinking of it as line bundle, let's think of them as circle bundles on X with connection, but don't worry about that for the moment. Then an object here gives us an obvious generalization of an object there. You see, once we have a circle bundle, we can, instead of considering circle-valued functions, we can consider cross-sections of this varying bundle, this varying circle, which varies from point to point. So when you have an object of this kind, it has cross-sections which are objects of this kind. And that happens in general, that if I give one of these bundles of algebras, I can precisely talk about cross-sections of it, which are bundles of the objects of the one kind up. So that on the space X, I would have, you see, just as a section of this is a twisted kind of circle-valued function, so when I have an object of type 3, a gerb, then what it defines for me is a twisted notion of line bundle, so a modification of the notion of an electromagnetic field, which is associated to this third-level object. And, of course, one wants precisely to be able to do field theory. That would be doing, if we considered objects of this kind that were sections of a particular object of type 3, we would say that was electromagnetic theory in the presence of a gerb, a B field or something. I already explained that one can think of these things as B fields on the space. I think that's really all I want to say. The cross sections, you see, can obviously be given a definition directly in that language. So I think I've said probably more than enough on this subject. I was going to talk about abelian duality, but it's clear that I will never get anywhere if I start pursuing that. So now I want to go back to K-theory. And I think I'm going to say one or two rather basic things about K-theory that, in retrospect, I'm sorry I didn't say right at the beginning, because they are probably more relevant to a lot of the things that come up in connection with strings and D-brains than a lot of things I actually did say. So I think if you're not familiar with K-theory, you really ought to sort of think a little bit about the most elementary aspects. So remember, we're talking now about a compact space X. It'll usually be a manifold. So, in fact, let's suppose that this is a compact manifold, a smooth manifold. Then remember, elements of this could be defined by vector bundles on X, but I explained a better way of doing it was to think of them as pairs of vector bundles with a map between them, a bundle map. So these are both bundles on X. And you think of this, you think of the element as being the difference between this bundle and this bundle. So at points where F is an isomorphism, you think of the two halves as cancelling each other out, and you don't have anything. You have essentially zero. So that means that an object like this has a support the points where F is not an isomorphism. Now, the important thing is that K-theory is filtered by the dimension of the support. I mean, I'm not saying that an element of K-theory has a precise support, but given an element of K-theory, we can represent it like this in various ways, and you can ask what is the smallest dimensional manifold in which you're forced to make this not an isomorphism. Now, this filtration, so you can sort of say, the simplest kinds of objects are ones where you could make this an isomorphism outside some naught-dimensional things, outside a bunch of points. The next most complicated thing are when you could make it an isomorphism outside something of codimension 2. It will go up in steps of 2, and then things outside things of dimension 4, and so on. Now, this filtration is very closely related to the theory of Chern classes. And remember, the reason why we introduced these delinear cohomologies classes was they were really what Chern classes were elements of. So we have the Chern classes. If you have a bundle E on X, it has Chern classes which attempt to describe it, tell you to what extent it is and isn't trivial. And the way to think of that is, supposing this is a bundle of fiber dimension capital N, we're comparing it with the trivial bundle of the same dimension. Well, we choose a generic map, just as in this case, and we ask to what extent it's not an isomorphism. Well, let's so we choose it as generic as possible, so to speak, and we say, well, it will be at each point this matrix will have a determinant. So the determinant will be a complex valued function on the space. It will vanish, presumably, on a submanifold of codimension 2. That represents a two-dimensional cohomology class. That's the first Chern class of the bundle. So generically, this will be an isomorphism outside something of codimension 2. That's the first Chern class. That's the obstruction to pushing down one step, so to speak, in this filtration. Well, then look, however, just at the... this is at each point we have an n by n matrix. Let's just look at the first n minus 1 columns. You see, having looked at whether or not the matrix itself is non-singular, let's look at the set of points where the first n minus 1 columns become linearly dependent. That will generically define a submanifold of codimension 4, because there are two complex conditions to make these things linearly dependent. So the first n minus 1 columns will be linearly dependent on a cycle of codimension 4. That will be the second Jones class. But then we look at the n minus 2 columns and so on until we finally get to the first column. The first column, that's just a vector-valued function. It's very visible that that will generically vanish on something of codimension n. So that will be the submanifold of this of codimension n. That's the nth Chern class. So you see, we associate, by looking at those things, we associate a collection of things which are cycles of the various dimensions up to the top, which if you think about it, each one of these things will be the obstruction to saying that the thing, the element, belongs one class down in the filtration. And so up to filtration, these things determine the bundle completely. Well, I'm cheating a little bit about torsion at this point, but this is meant to make clear to you that K of X looks roughly like H naught of X. That just keeps track of the dimension of the bundle with integer coefficients. Well, in general, we can have bundles of all dimensions, so we go all the way up. It looks like this, where you keep track of the dimension, and then the first Chern class, and so on, up to the nth Chern class. Now, this is, however, only approximately an isomorphism, because this isn't a direct sum, it's somehow filtered. Now, what you can do, the problem, as I said here, is only torsion, and what there is an actual map made out of these Chern classes from this into, let's call that H even, with rational coefficients, which is an isomorphism rationally. In other words, if I tensor this thing, this is an abelian group, if I tensor it with the rational, it will become isomorphic to that. That's the Chern fact. Now, that's made out of the Chern classes. It's, if you think of the Chern classes as 1 plus C1 plus C2 plus C3, it's, you see, that you can easily see that that's an exponential kind of thing. The total Chern class multiplies when you add the bundles. So you want to take the logarithm of this as a formal series to get something additive. And in fact, that's near enough to being right. That's the Chern character. Perhaps I should be a tiny bit more honest, shouldn't I? The Chern character is actually, if I put a T in this, it's T d by dt of this, isn't it? Evaluated at T equals 1. Anyway, it's something, you see, when you work out the logarithm of this power series, you have to introduce rational numbers because of the series with the logarithm. And that's where the rational numbers get into it. But you see, it's only the difference between this and the K-theory just consists of these finite groups. Now, this brings me back to the question of Poincaré duality, which I like so much and which I'm trying to hammer. Because, you see, I motivated this just now in terms of the description of homology by cycles. I said, by trying to make this map an isomorphism, it fails to be an isomorphism, successive steps, and we keep track of those as cycles in X. But of course, this has a completely other description, which you're probably more familiar with, in that if we were to think of cohomology as being defined by differential forms, then the Chern character of E is then represented as a differential form by taking E to the curvature of a connection in A. So we take E, we choose a connection in it, We take the curvature matrix of that. So this is the exponential of a matrix of two forms. And then we simply take the trace of that, and then we'll get a differential form of mixed degree, and this represents the Chern character. Now, you see, that's a totally different description coming from a kind of a different universe. And the fact that you have those two opposite descriptions, in fact, this actually defines a delinear class, because, you see, here we had a bundle with connection in a specific differential form. That's this, as I say, very deep duality, which here I'm seeing in cohomology, the fact that we have, on the one hand, cycles, on the other hand, differential forms. Well, I want to talk about how that manifests itself in K-theory. So, I told you, just saying one more word about cohomology before coming to K-theory, remember I told you how X had a dual space UX plus, but if, for instance, the manifold was parallelizable, we could identify this with a suspension of X. So for a parallelizable manifold, we actually have on X, a kind of, this is a parallelizable manifold of dimension n, we have an actual map to Rn compactified, which is an n-dimensional sphere. Now, I realized one of the things I didn't explain at all properly was why this had anything to do with intersection of cycles. So let me just say that quickly. So what is this map? I did actually tell it to you in a sequence of moves, but let me say it to you in the simplest case where X is parallelizable. We have X, we have a pair of points, and we want to get into the sphere. Well, we're assuming the manifold is parallelizable, so if I have X1 and X2, and they're close together, I can find a tangent vector which goes from one to the other, and I can identify that tangent vector with something in Rn. Well, let's just do that. So to each pair of points, we associate this tangent vector. But if it has length more than some fixed small epsilon, which you choose, then take this to infinity. In other words, think of this one-point compactification as got by taking the vectors of length less than epsilon and taking the one-point compactification of that. So infinity here is everything which is of length greater than epsilon. But then you have this map. And now you see, I think you'll see at once why this is counting intersections. You see, supposing X is two-dimensional, so this is the picture we have here. We're looking at points in the plane. And supposing we want to look at, say, what happens when we have two cycles. Supposing we have a cycle that this is lying on and a cycle that this is lying on. So this is where you have a cycle here, C1, and a cycle here, C2. Then restricting to those cycles, we'll get a map from this to Sn. And it's clearly counting the intersection. You see, if you let X1 run along this and X2 run along this, then except when you're near the point of intersection, the output over here will be constant. You see, if you fix this point and let the other one go a long way away, then the vector joining that one to this one will be at the point at infinity most of the time. And similarly, when you turn other way around, the only time you'll get anything really appearing is when these two points are both within epsilon. So nothing will happen except when we're in an epsilon neighborhood of an intersection point. And then you see if they intersect transversely, if you map that across that, this interval across this interval to R2 by looking at the difference of the two vectors, that's clearly just a map of degree 1 if they're intersecting transversely. And of course, if you reverse the orientation, you'd reverse the factors here, and that's why orientations, why intersections have a sign. You get a map of a particular degree. Right. Well, now, K-theory. It's constant. It's constant except in a neighborhood, an epsilon neighborhood of the intersection points. And at the intersection point, it measures the intersection multiplicity, according to one definition of intersection multiplicity, where it's just the degree of the map you get from a little bit of this cycle across a little bit of that cycle to the true sphere, in this case, by... And you can see that it localizes. And actually, remember what I said in the last lecture? There is this notion in algebraic geometry that the intersection of cycles is really the homology of a space. It's the Euler number of a certain space. And this is the space we're talking about. You see, we're really looking at a little space of maps to the sphere. You see that very clearly in the Fleur homology definition, where you're considering the Fleur homology of the space of all things, strings going from one Lagrangian submanifold to another. Anyway, time to get back to K-theory, which I'm not going to say very much, I think, by now. But I really do want to talk about transradiality in K-theory in a more first principles way than I did. You see, corresponding to this intersection of cycles, we'd really like to have a map from K of X across K of X to K of a point, which is red. Now, you see, I said we always want to think of K-theory, of Planck-radiality in two stages. We say that on the one hand, the space has a dual space, and then we say that if the thing is a manifold, the dual space looks like the original space. Actually, let me go back already to this question of filtration. One thing I wanted just to say about that going the other way, which is closely related to this. Supposing we had a submanifold Y of X, remember. So this is a submanifold, smooth submanifold. Then I want to say that, you see, I talked about what it meant for an element of K-theory to be supported on here, but conversely, if I have a vector bundle on here, I want to be able to put it inside the K-theory there. So in other words, I want to be able to make K-theory behave homologically. I want to be able to go upwards, so to speak, of that filtration, so that things here give us elements. Now, I did explain this, but I'll say it again, because I'll try and say it a little bit differently. I want to say that this is functorial in that situation. We get a map from K there. And if this is called F, this is called F shriek, this operation. So the idea will be we're going to associate to a vector bundle on this an element of K-theory which has support on Y. It's somehow the... And it's meant to correspond to the operation in cohomology, which is called F lower star, which would correspond to taking a differential form on Y and multiplying it by a Gaussian thing in the perpendicular direction. So this would go from I to I plus the codimension of Y, because we're multiplying by a Gaussian differential form in the transverse direction. Now, I want to say this in such a way as to explain how it relates to this Chern character isomorphism. Now, how do we get this map? Well, we get it as a composite of several things. So I should say it's only defined when the normal bundle has a spin C structure. But the best way to say that is, remember, I told you about K-theory of bundles of algebras. So we can put on Y the bundle of Clifford algebras of the normal bundle. This is the normal bundle of Y. So we can consider not just bundles on Y, but bundles of modules for the Clifford algebra. And if there is an irreducible module for that bundle of Clifford algebras, that is to say, if the normal bundle has a spin C structure, then we have a Morita isomorphism. This class that I talked about before of NY is zero. This is this three-dimensional integral cohomology class that is defined by this bundle of algebras. But then I explained we have the Thom isomorphism that goes from that into K of NY with compact supports. And then we go from k into x, where this is trivial extension. See, first of all, this map. If I get into, think of the normal bundle of y sitting inside x, we have this normal bundle. If I give something along there with compact support, that means it becomes trivial outside the neighborhood. We can then just extend any way we like by two isomorphic bundles over the rest of the space. So this is of no interest. We really want to get something supported in this immediate neighborhood of X. That's like multiplying by the Gaussian thing. Now, exactly the same thing happens here, except we don't need to put this stage in. We have the Chern character into Y. We have the Chern character into things with compact support of N of Y. And the important thing is the F star that goes that far, going the rest of the way. Nothing happens in this square, that commutes. Well, what was this map? I did tell you it before. Remember, if I had a bundle of modules for the Clifford algebra, remember, that meant at each y here, I had a fiber EY, and I know how to multiply it by normal vectors. So let's just, when I had a normal vector psi, remember, I multiplied in the Clifford sense by that. And that gave me a bundle of things on there where we had an isomorphism away from the zero section. Now, the thing that you really need to know to read papers in V-brains, or at least the thing that kind of makes mathematicians' hair stand on end when they do so, is the fact that this diagram, of course, doesn't commute. We have the operation of pushing the vector bundle forward, we have the operation of pushing the cohomology class forward by the Gaussian normal form. This doesn't commute, but the formula relating them is the... in fact, on this level that I'm telling you, it's more or less trivial formula, but you just have to do a calculation relating to this bundle of Clifford modules, is that if you take the Chern character of F sharp of V, then that's equal to F star, not of the Chern character of E, as you might expect, but this divided by the A hat genus of the normal bundle. Now, I'm not going to tell you what that is, but all string theorists seem to lap it up with their mother's milk. This is some cohomology class of Y, which is associated, which you have for any vector bundle, any with a spin C structure. This is some cohomology class which tells you, well, it's actually telling you about the Chern character of this spin bundle itself. And you have to, because here you just take a Gaussian form, and there you take something which is kind of interesting in the vector bundle direction, you get this factor. Well, of course, that's kind of, now, that's the first point. Now we want to get, however, back to Poincaré duality proper. And you see, I told you K theory is represented by vector bundles. But I said X had a dual space, X star, which was this compactification of a neighborhood. This is a neighborhood in some, remember UX was contained in some large Euclidean space, whose dimension was just arbitrarily large. So as we make this larger, this thing will multiply by copies of R. So we should consider a formal desuspension. Don't really worry about that, but we want to keep track of the number of superfluous dimensions in the notation by saying formally we pull off capital N dimensions. You see, these theories didn't change when we suspended the space. So we can at least think in terms of a space which has been desuspended. Suspending is just multiplying by R. So we define for any cohomology theory, K-theory, homology, any kind of generalized cohomology theory, homology groups of X, any space X, as cohomology spaces of the dual space And if you didn't like that notation, which I don't really think you should have, that's the same as saying hn minus I of the one point of ux with compact supports, or if you like, hn minus I of the one point compactification. So this is a universal definition for the homology theory when you have a cohomology theory. And the sort of universal duality which I told you about in the first lecture, that manifests itself in the fact that we, if you define, you always have then a pairing like this. We always have a pairing like that, saying that these things are more or less dual. And so we'd like, however, to say that, to have a better description of this space in the case of K-theory. You see, in the case, you see, imagine we were studying cohomology and we defined this by differential forms. Then this would give us a definition of homology, but it will be very useful also to know that homology classes can be represented by cycles. So that will be an independent definition of the homology which you didn't make out of the cohomology. So what is the corresponding definition? So we define by this k lower something. This is, so to speak, k upper star, but I'm really only ever considering k naught, because by Bott periodicity that's really enough for all practical purposes. So we wanted to find k lower naught of x. Well, of course, we have a definition by that abstract procedure, but we want another definition. And I've already given you one kind of definition. I said, whereas this could be defined by bundles, which were projective modules over C of x, this could be defined as a Grothendieck group of finite dimensional modules over C of x. So these points labeled with finite dimensional vector spaces. Actually, that gives you a theory called connective K theory, which leaves out brains and is not Bott periodic. In algebraic geometry, I've also mentioned a candidate for this. This is defined by vector bundles. This is defined by coherent sheaves. Now, coherent sheaves are very like cycles. You see, the prime examples of coherent sheaves are the functions along some complex submanifold. But of course, that only makes sense in the algebraic geometric context, where we're working with Kähler manifolds, things like that. Now, a long time ago, Atiyah and Singer worked out a description of this, which is not of the kind that I've been emphasizing in these lectures, in that what I've been emphasizing is that somehow the cohomology of anything was something defined sort of globally, smeared out over the whole space, whereas the homology was something that was concentrated around points. But there's another description of the dual theory in terms of so-called elliptic operators on x, elliptic differential operators. Now, if x is a smooth manifold, I can certainly talk about genuine elliptic differential operators. What would that mean? A genuine elliptic differential operator, to give that, we would give a pair of vector bundles, E plus and E minus. We would take their smooth cross-sections, and we would have some operator P, which took sections of one to sections of the other. So this would be two finitely generated projective modules, if you like, over the functions on X, and a map between them. Now, a differential operator is not a vector bundle map. It doesn't commute with multiplying by functions the way a vector bundle map would. If you take a vector bundle map, induces a map on sections, which is a module map with respect to multiplying by functions. So the Atiyah Singer version of K lower star was as formal elliptic operators on X. We formalized the situation by saying, we look at the functions on X, we take two modules, say gamma plus and gamma minus, which you think of as the cross sections of those two bundles, and we define a Fredholm operator P So something that has finite dimensional kernel and co-kernel. And the sense in which it imitates a general elliptic operator is that although this doesn't commute with multiplying by functions, if we consider its commutator with multiplying by functions, we want that to be somehow small. You see, when you commute a differential operator with multiplying by a function, what you get is a differential operator of lower degree, so something which is small compared with what you started off with. So if we ask for this to be a bounded Fredholm operator, which is not what would normally happen if you had a differential operator of positive degree, let's not worry about that, then we can ask for this to be small in the sense of being a compact operator for all f. That's about the only thing you could do on the level of spaces in continuous maps. The compact operator is one which is nearly of finite rank. It's a limit in a very strong sense of operators of finite rank, the limit in the norm topology of operators of finite rank. So Mathieu and Singer developed this thing, L of X, the formal elliptic operators, and they didn't quite prove, I dare say, that this was exactly K lower north of X. However, that was the taking off point from this vast program of Kohn and many other people, but Kohn is certainly the sort of prime representative. Kohn developed an enormous theory on the basis of this, and one can now do this all very, very beautifully, and there's a tremendous body of knowledge associated with it. Well, where is it, how does it relate to the present subject? Yes, the problem with this definition is that it's rather difficult to say when two objects like this are equivalent. And that was why the original program faltered, and then it got sort of overwhelmed by this huge machine from Paris. You can read all that. Well, it's a long story, that, which I obviously can't go into now. But the important thing is, so I have to explain why. Sorry?
There was an intermediate step of Douglas.
Yes, yes.
Which straightened it out, I think, before it
came. Yeah, yeah. There's a large history involved in this. I have to explain at least why is this even vaguely plausible as a candidate for the dual. Well, you see, this thing P is a Fredholm operator, so it has an index, it has an integer associated to it. So the thing we most obviously have is the index, which goes from that into Z. Just let me say, supposing this was not just a compact operator, but was actually zero. So supposing we had a Fredholm operator which actually commuted with multiplication by functions, then the kernel and co-kernel would be finite dimensional vector spaces which had a C of X action. So they would be exactly these things which I described as points of the non-abelian spectrum in the previous lecture. So the case where these actually commute rather than just being compact is the K lower star, which is actually called non-periodic connective K lower star in the trade. It's the theory I was referring to before when I introduced that non-abelian spectrum. But the important thing to hang on to is that we have this index. Even better, we have a pairing K of X, L of X, going to Z. Because when you have a genuine elliptic operator and you have some auxiliary vector bundle with a connection, you can tensor these two bundles you already have, part of the operator, with the auxiliary bundle, say F, and take that tensor F and this tensor F. And then the operator can be itself coupled, as one would say in physics, to F. If you know how to differentiate or whatever you're doing sections of the original bundle, then at the expense of introducing a covariant derivative in F, you know how to differentiate sections of E tensor F. So we have even a bilinear pairing like that, and then we can do the index and get into Z. Now, I claim that this is the duality pairing, right? So it says, given a bundle and an elliptic operator, the natural K-theory pairing is the index. But this is just for any space, not necessarily for a manifold. So we'd like to say that for a manifold, we have Poincaré duality, and so that K of X resembles this. So how do we go from that to that? Well, as usual, there are two stages. We go from K of X into not the bundles, but the bundles of modules for the Clifford algebra. So this we should perhaps write dotted, in that this is what you can do. This exists for a spin C manifold. So this is the thing you might or might not be able to do. This is a slightly twisted form of K-theory coming from this bundle of algebras. However, what we can always do is define a map here, which is the Dirac operator. What does that mean? You see, supposing you have, what is an object of this? Well, it's a pair of bundles, E plus and E minus, which are not just bundles, but they're bundles of modules for the Clifford algebra. So each fiber here, we can multiply by anything in the Clifford algebra, by any psi, where psi is in the Clifford algebra of the tangent space of X. So we can then write down a Dirac operator. We take cross sections, we define our Dirac operator for any such Clifford module as taking a section of this and taking it to sigma. The usual formula, gamma I d by dx I of S, where this is a covariant derivative in this bundle in the direction I, and this is multiplying by the corresponding Clifford element, the element of the Clifford, the tangent vector in the I-th direction thought of as an element of the Clifford algebra. That makes good sense because we know how to multiply these sections by things in the Clifford algebra. So this is a covariant derivative, and of course that formula is independent of the basis I chose in the tangent space. That's just I wanted to write it in the way that people traditionally write it. So for any one of these things we have a Dirac operator, and this is meant to be an isomorphism, and this is our Poincaré duality. Now, I'm just going to say about two more words. We obviously want to know how this relates then. See, so for a spin manifold, for a spin manifold, this actually gives us a pairing. Which takes E1, E2, well, let's write it like that, is equal to the index of the Dirac operator coupled to E1 tends to E2. But we'd like to know, if we do the Chern factor, we get into cohomology. Going to 2 because this is rational cohomology. That's the obvious inclusion. What is the formula? How does this relate? Well, again, the formula is given by that thing for the same reason. The formula is, of course, that the pairing in K theory is equal to the pairing in cohomology. Multiplied by the A roof genus and bundle of X. So we get exactly the same A factor that Chern factor, sorry. So So this is the K-theory pairing. This is the H-star pairing. So this is just multiplying and integrating. So this is just the integral over X, the Chern character. You notice that in the formula I gave you before, we divided by the A-roof genus. That was because we were putting something into something. The normal bundle was the extent to which the thing we were going into was bigger than the thing we were coming out of. Here we're going from X to a point. So the tangent bundle is the extent to which the tangent bundle on the initial thing is bigger. And that's why we divide in one formula and multiply in the other. That's a simple point. Well, that's just about all I wanted to say, but obviously there's a huge story here. For example, when we had families of these things, this formula, when properly interpreted in the linear cohomology, is still true. And this gives you all kinds of formulae for holonomy of determinant bundles and so on. And that's why it's rather important to do this in the sort of more general context. And that now plays quite a role even in arithmetic algebraic geometry, number theory, that sort of thing. Kahn, as I say, made this vast machine. One of the remarks Kahn often used to make was that he'd been to at least 100 talks which ought to have been entitled "Now I Too Have Understood the Atiyah-Singer Index Theorem." I have let you down in the sense that I haven't said anything about what I wanted to explain about, so I'm just going to say about two words about the topic that I've left out, but I really kind of in the end decided to leave it out deliberately because it's a hobby horse of my own which might or might not be of any interest, and I really thought it would be better to give a more basic lecture. But what I was going to say was, remember, I was trying to propagandize for this space of virtual vector bundles, which was the maps of X into the Fredholm operators. Well, a long time ago, this space can be described, perhaps a clearer way of thinking of this space is the Grassmannian of n-dimensional subspaces of C infinity for large n. That's not absolutely right, but that's near enough to what I want to say now. A long time ago, Michael Atiyah gave a very nice description, of the K-theory of this space in the following way. There's an obvious bundle on this, a tautological bundle, because each point of this space is an n-dimensional vector space. So there's an obvious bundle, and one way of stating the relationship of Hermann Weyl between representations of the unitary group and representations of the symmetric group is that you get all bundles on this space by taking this bundle, taking its tensor powers, and decomposing them according to representations of the symmetric group. So Atiyah proved that this, you have to be, I'm messing up all the large n limits and things in here, that this is isomorphic to the sum for all k of the representation ring of the symmetric group on k letters. So this is the correspondence between representations of the unitary group and representations of the symmetric group. Well, the only thing I was really going to say was that this generalizes that the K-theory of X by pretty much the same argument, you see, this is the case when X is a point, is the sum over all K of, well, how does a representation of this K-symmetric group vary? Well, you take the K-theory of K copies of X, and then you make it equivariant for the K-symmetric group. And then you get this statement, which interprets again this space as these things. And these are the things which Robert Dykroff pointed out are the same as the cohomology of the K-Hilbert scheme of X in the case when X is an algebraic surface. Well, so you see, you can describe this space in terms of a sort of particle-like description that way around. But I also told you that Poincaré duality gives you a description of it in terms of those non-commutative moduli spaces. That's a different description of it. And you see, I wanted to say that the So there are two totally different ways of identifying elements of K-theory with configurations of points in X, and I wanted to relate that to some kind of best duality in string theory, but anyway, it's certainly time to stop.
Thanks for the series.
Yeah, that's great.